Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. This is your host, Jackson Hogan, here today with the incomparable Mike Hattrop, soon to be formally inducted into the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame. It's doubtful you'll remember Hattrop from his competition career, as knee injuries cut it short, and as soon as he was back in one piece, he began to ski for the camera, a period for which he is very well remembered indeed. Hattrop had already had a couple of Greg Stumps films on his resume when he was tapped to join Scott Schmidt and Glenn Plake, likewise in the Hall of Fame, to star in The Blizzard of Oz. If you've never heard of this movie, shame on you, for as revealed in The Legend of Oz, it inspired virtually every important post-Blizzard ski maker to follow his dream. But Hattrop didn't make it into the hall based on his credentials as an athlete, nor his filmed exploits, but for a career that included those laurels and his pioneering work in the backcountry arena. A certified guide, he could walk the uphill walk, and his passion for telemark turns led to employment at K2, building his first line of backcountry skis. Hattrop would stay at K2, on and off, maybe, for X number of years. We'll find out how many years. Learning the craft of ski making and how to build and promote a line. 5 years ago, I think it was, he took those skills to Fisher, where he directly influenced the design of its hybrid alpine backcountry ski boots and the Ranger ski series coming out in the fall of 2022. That assignment done and dusted, he has moved on to Black Diamond, where he can limit his focus to new product development exclusively without the added baggage of marketing and sales duties. Welcome, dear friend. I'm thrilled to have you on the show.
Thanks, Jackson. I'm stoked to be here with you.
This will be fun. Before we go rummaging around in the murky past, tell us what you can about your current work at Black Diamond. Describe, if you would, a typical day on the job and fill us in on when you started there, what's your assignment, and will your work allow you to keep living in Sun Valley? You can answer those questions in any order you wish.
Okay, yeah. So I started at Black Diamond not quite a year ago. It'll be a year in August. I'm the business unit director for for snow, which includes really all the ski products. So it's skis, it's Beak and Shovel Probe, Jet Force airbags, skins, and Pulse. So there's a lot of different products in
that
there.
Sounds basically like a everything. Lot. That sounds like, yeah, a lot, but every, Black Diamond does other stuff too, right? So in fact, you're not doing everything they do, but you're doing everything they do within ski?
Yes, correct. Because there's five different divisions. There's Mountain, which includes the trekking poles and headlamps and packs and tents. Stuff like that. And then there's an apparel division. There's a footwear division. So yeah, there's a lot of products there. That's one of the strengths and one of the challenges of the brand.
So you're capo di tutti capi, and that includes R&D. And then you, once they're ready for market, you turn them over to another team.
Yeah. So it's definitely a product development role, which is great. Cause that's what I love working on. And I work with a bunch of engineers. There are a ton of engineers at Black Diamond. It's super, super engineering heavy.
Well, I guess you're supposed to, because your life's kind of at risk if it fails, right?
Yes. So that's why Black Diamond exists, because it was, of course, Chouinard Equipment and part of that, and they got sued. And Peter Metcalf, who was a former CEO and president, raised his hand and said, we'll take the liability. We'll move this from Ventura to Salt Lake and create a new brand. And that's how Black Diamond got started roughly a little over 30 years ago now. And like I said, we're in Salt Lake, and kind of the irony of the job, I was remote for 27 years before anybody was remote, really. And now everybody's remote and I got a commute. So I'm going back and forth to Salt Lake. It actually works out pretty well. It's a long drive. It's 4.5 hours. So I'm commuting 9 hours a week. And when I think back, this is how I rationalize it in my mind. When I think back to my days at K2, when K2 was over on Vashon Island, it took an hour to get there because you had to drive to the ferry, take the ferry, and then drive on the other side. And if the ferries weren't late and you didn't miss one, then it was an hour. In actuality, I was commuting 10 to 12 hours a week then versus 9 now. So I'd rather do it all in a couple long trips, because that 2-hour bite out of every day, that's a skin up the hill or a few hours on Baldy or a bike ride or whatever you want.
Maybe a little time with the family?
Yeah, hopefully with all of that stuff. Yeah.
We'll get back to family matters later on. But now that we have a grasp of your current obsessions, let's peel back the veil of time to the other end of your ski life. Where did you grow up skiing? How did you get into bump competitions? My understanding that you were on the Northwest USSA mogul circuit, right? That was sort of your stepping stone upwards, if you will.
Yeah, that's where I started. So I grew up in Seattle and grew up skiing, learned to ski at Alpental, which is a great little hill about an hour from Seattle. Really good terrain there. And then my family bought a cabin up at Crystal Mountain, which is also an amazing hill. I didn't know how good either of those hills were until I started traveling around and saw some of the famed Colorado and other areas and went, wow, Crystal's better than this. But of course, we also learned to ski a lot of heavy, ooh, difficult snow, and not on a fat rockered powder ski, mind you. These were long, sinkers, skinny, yeah, misery sticks. So it was a challenge. But, and we also skied in the rain, which I appreciate now, because not that I want to, but it's not so bad. I don't mind it. I can deal with it. And there's a lot of days, certainly testing skis over the years at Mount Bachelor and Mount Hood in May and June, you know, we often had rain at the bottom and then would switch to snow halfway up. And so you were soaked and then frozen. And
the East Coast doesn't quite have the halfway up part. It pretty much rains from the bottom all the way to the top. So both coasts have shared this culture of rain. I'll never forget going into, I think it was the Shed or someplace. It was in Stowe, which Shed may be in Killington. I'm going to get my bars mixed up, but it was an after skiing rendezvous point at Stowe. And sitting at the bar, there were all these relatively gray-bearded guys, not that I shouldn't be talking now, mind you, but then they were talking about what a great day of skiing it was. Absolutely sensational. Better than Kitzbühel, better than Val d'Isère. It rained every minute of that day. And they were carrying on about how great it was. I was like, well, there's no cure for this. These people are totally lost.
Well, it shows you how passionate skiers are.
Yeah.
You know, and that's I think, one of the beautiful things of the sport.
How'd you get into mogul skiing?
Well, I grew up skiing in the 70s, and of course, freestyle was all the rage then. So I actually, the only experience I had with racing at that age is, I remember it was, you know, I think it was my first year skiing, and the gates were big wooden snowmen. And I think I hit one and it's like, this isn't any fun. So I think that was the end of my racing career.
Did injury end your competition career as it was, or was it just opportunity to do something else? What was the transition for you out of competition?
It was some of each. My goal had always been to get to the U.S. ski team as a mogul competitor, and I made it there. And then, I guess, maybe a month or so before the first competition, I tore my ACL. So I didn't get it fixed right away. I got a brace. And still went to compete. And that was the competition was at Lake Placid. So you can imagine what the moguls were like. Yeah. Rock hard. And I tore meniscus there. Yeah, I had a spot the next year on the team. But I also got the invite to go to Chamonix with Stump to shoot Blizzard of Oz. And I didn't even know where that was going to lead, of course. Then it would have made the
decision
easy.
But you'd already shot with Stumpy before that invite, right?
Yeah. I'd shot a couple of years with him before.
On what, spring break?
Yeah, it was really after the mogul. He actually invited me to shoot with him the first time, and I said no because it was right before Nationals, and I was super focused on trying to get on the U.S. team. So okay. I didn't shoot with him then until after Nationals was over. Then I went and shot with him, and we had a blast. So at any rate, I opted to go to Chamonix instead of another year. Well, another year, one half a run, I guess. I probably have the distinction of having the shortest career on the U.S. team ever. So.
Not exactly Hall of Fame material.
No.
I was told by none other than Greg Stump that you were actually introduced to him by a cinematographer, Bruce Benedict, who had shot you at Steamboat. What was he doing shooting you at Steamboat?
Yeah, you know, I don't remember. I don't remember how he got hooked up with Bruce Benedict, but it was a buddy of mine, one of the Goon Squad, Dennis McNamara, and I went out and shot with him, and he gave us all these bright SOS clothing to wear.
Yes,
and there was a shot of us both popping off this little bump next to each other, and it looked like he was going to undercut me and take me out right at the feet. And the caption was best dressed photo about to, or best dressed crash about to happen.
Yeah, as, so, and you were run into very famously later on in a couloir in Chamonix by Mr. Plank. Had your feet taken.
Yes, yes.
Right. That, you had a lump in your throat when that happened. yeah, Stumpy immediately was charmed by you, by the way. He told me how much he really, you were his favorite, you were his class favorite, because you were funny and you skied. You had a great aggressive skiing style that he really admired. And you were his favorite athlete to film, which I think is quite a credit because you weren't the only athlete he ever filmed.
No, that's a huge compliment.
You went to University of Washington, is that right? Were you very studious at Washington, or were you trying to get out of town as often as you could to go somewhere else and ski?
Well, I never went to school more than one quarter in a row. So it was fall quarter, then winter quarter was off. I was on a quarter system, which was nice. And then I'd go back to school spring, and then summer would be off. So I did that.
Keep up with the curriculum, more or less.
Yeah, I'm keeping up. It depends on how you define keeping up. it took me 7 years to get through undergrad, so I should probably be a surgeon now. But
tell me about the Goon Squad that you just mentioned. Who did it comprise, and what were you guys up to?
The Goon Squad was a bunch of guys from Seattle, a bunch of freestyle competitors from Seattle. Several of them ended up on the World Cup. And it was a crew that I moved around with each winter. The first winter I took off from school, I went to Sun Valley to live. And after that, we moved to Squaw Valley and then Steamboat and then Winter Park. And each time I would go with this same crew of guys, or at least a mix of them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, still friends with all those guys today. I don't see all of them that often, but the guy that I first moved to Sun Valley with and who was in that best dress crash about to happen lives in Sun Valley with me now. So
who was filming when you crawled through the takeout window of a liquor store?
I think you've got a couple stories combined there.
That's what the past does. Gets smooshed together.
To my recollection, nobody was filming, but we were shooting. I'm pretty sure that was the very first movie, Time Waits for Snowman, that I did with Stump, and it was a drive-in. And I think taking longer than I expected, so I crawled through the window, and I was standing there when the gal turned around and said, "Can I help?" And she's like almost jumped out of her skin. Yeah,
that's a pretty good prank. Any other pranks from that day? Most days from a name like the Goon Squad kind of suggests that something's going on.
Oh, there were constant. Yeah, there was a constant stream of pranks with that group. None that I can recall that day.
Okay, what other tricks did you do either with Stumpy or anyone else, other than Blizzard of Oz, Time Waits for Snowman?
Yeah, so first was Time Waits for Snowman, then it was Maltese Flamingo, then I tore my ACL, I sat out the Good, the Rad, and the Gnarly, and then I came back for Blizzard, and then License to Thrill after that, which we shot largely up at Blackholm, and then Dr. Strangelove was the last one I did with Stump, and then I did three with Warren Miller, roughly 10 years apart on each of them. I think it was like 30, 40, and 50. And that was all in Europe.
Interesting. Okay. Was it involved mountaineering as well as downhill skiing?
No. Well, the last couple did. One was with Coombs, and that was segment was couloirs to bars, just lift service, and then some climbing or skiing. And with Coombs, Coombs always had a scheme on a helicopter somehow. I'm pretty sure we went way over budget. I know we went way over budget on the last two with helicopter time, because normally you got one helicopter and four groups and they're shuttling everybody.
Right.
We had two helicopters sitting there waiting at our disposal for that one.
Wow.
So that was pretty special. And that one was with Tim Patrick from K2 and Seth Morrison and Miles Smart.
You and I had a few adventures together over time. Some have been in the bars part, some have been on the on-hill part. Remember the night in Saspe when, I don't know if it was you or it was Tate, who spotted the steins behind the bar that held like five gallons of Hefeweizen or some obscene amount of beer.
That was me, and we just finished. There was a, you were on that trip. We just finished dinner. It was probably 10:30 at night. And of course we had several drinks with dinner and it was a long day of skiing and I was toast. And Patrick said, let's go have one beer. And I said, nah, I'm good. He goes, come on, just one. I said, nah, I don't need it. He goes, come on. So finally I relented and we got to the bar and I'm sitting there and there's a huge decorative stein behind the bar that was like, I mean, it was massive.
It was like a meter tall or something. It was
yeah. And so I went to the bartender. I said, how much to fill that? And he looked at it. You know, nobody had ever asked that before. And he said, 60 francs. I said, I'd like one of those. So that was my one beer. And I ordered this beer. And it took like 15 minutes to fill the thing. Yeah, I got it. And it's like, okay. And took a and put it down and it was like down like a centimeter, like, oh shit, it's gonna be rocking. So that got passed around. It wasn't I didn't drink it solely, thank God.
Well, it wasn't just you, dear listeners. You should know that the charming Tate Wardlaw was on that trip. And I remember you and him playing darts. Neither of you, of course, were all competitive, despite your state, and are trying to win the dart game. But Tate decided to dispense with the darts, and he would just headbutt the dart board from charge from the normal legal line and hurl himself headfirst into the wall. Yeah,
as I recall, it was electric, so he might have still scored that way, as he wouldn't have if it was a true dart board.
Oh God, we have their shenanigans of the Snowmass Winter Games. I remember being at the bar for sure with Plake, maybe you, with about three shots of Sambuca welded to my ass. We were doing butt shots. And I think it was while we were doing butt shots or shortly thereafter that some young shop employee, this is a program called Winter Games, dear listeners, that K2 brilliantly sponsored and lowered all the barriers of cost low enough for shop personnel to come from all around the U.S. and go skiing with their heroes. And this guy meets you on the pool table. He has no idea who you are. And first of all, he apparently must have wanted to humiliate himself at pool. And then not satisfied with that, he challenged you to a bump contest. You remember that character?
Oh, yeah. That was the first Pro Staff Games. And that was at Crested Butte, actually.
At Crested Butte. Okay, good.
Yeah. Again, we're combining stories because
I'm very good at that.
Yeah. Wanted to bet money, and I was playing a lot of pool at that time, and I happened to have a C note in my wallet, so I put it on the table. I said, okay, and he looks and is like, whoa. He goes, how about 20? I said, sure. So I put 20 down. He goes, how about 5? I go, let's just play, we don't need to play. And I ended up sinking the 8 ball on the break, so I won that one. And then we played again, and that's when he said, I'll ski you for money. And I went, okay. And then to fine tune, he goes, moguls. And I went, all right. So anyways, the flaming asshole was, I think that was it at Vail at Vendetta's. Because we had
more than one occasion, perhaps.
I'm not sure if you, yeah, it could be for sure that drink came out more than once. Stephen Lee, who was a Australian World Cup skier,
right,
showed me that. We were at Vendetta's, and more than two is a porcupine. And I think I had three that night at the same time. I ended up falling down and injuring my hand. It was all bloody. And of course, I just put a bandage on it and left it that night. And the next day, everybody's going, you got to get that thing looked at. So I went in and had it x-rayed. And the x-ray technician, I remember her name was Spike. They always ask you, you know, when's the last time you had a tetanus shot? of course, I couldn't remember if it's been less than 10 years, they give you another one. Right. So she said, we should give you a tetanus shot. And I said, okay. So she said, normally we give these to you in the shoulder, but I was at Vendetta's last night. And maybe you prefer to have it in the cheek.
Oh, that's yeah. a great story. One of my fondest memories of skiing with you was a gift you gave me after a day at Jackson Hole of a t-shirt. And the t-shirt was made as a Jackson Hole promo that had two pictures of the brain, sort of scientific style pictures. And on the left, there was a, this is your brain. And on the right, it said, this is your brain at Jackson Hole. And that brain was completely psychedelic and, you know, practically had, you know, Grateful Dead stickers on it. It was a totally tripped out brain. And you had cleverly taken a Sharpie and it changed that to, this is your brain with Jackson Hogan. Jackson Hole changed to Jackson Hogan very easily, ladies and gentlemen. And I wore that with great pride till I left it at a hot tub party, I think, in Alta. But
yeah, that was the classic. There was some commercials, this is your brain. This is your brain on drugs.
Right.
And of
right.
course, it was all fried and scrambled. And then Jackson Hole Hogan. Jackson Hole did a spin on that, which I thought aligned very perfectly with Jackson Hogan. So I couldn't help but make that t-shirt.
Indeed. Seems like every time I catch you on the phone, you're just back from Greenland or Norway or some far-flung corner of the earth, which you seem to do repetitively. Like you were just recently in the wilds of Washington, weren't you? You were off in some pretty deep backcountry?
Yeah, we were up around Mount Baker.
So my point is, yeah, you may be a ski designer, but first and foremost, you're a skier.
Most definitely, I'm first and foremost a skier, and which is and I'm not a designer. I'm not an engineer, you know. But I work with the designers, and I've learned a lot from that standpoint. But no, and I think that's one of the reasons that I've been successful in this is that I am the market. You know, for most right. of this. And right. I have huge passion for the sport still. So I'm deeply connected to it. And even if I'm not the exact market, I'm connected enough with those people that are, that I have a good feel for what people are looking for.
You're not just a poser, you're a legit guide. And ladies and gentlemen, we don't have this much in this country. We tend to think of PSIA as the people that try to train us on the mountain, but there's a whole other world beyond PSIA. If you want to train for being a legit backcountry and mountaineering expert. You have certainly become that if you weren't practically born into it. I know you were certified, if that's the appropriate expression, for Mount Rainier to be a guide, if you will.
No, I'm an AMGA, which is American Mountain Guide Association Ski Mountaineering Guide. IFMGA, which is the International Mountain Guiding Governing Body. There's countries all over the world that are involved in this, and you have to show the AMGA, if you're a country that wants to get in, you have to show the AMGA that you're teaching to the standards and your exams are at the standard of the IFMGA. So the U.S. was not part of that governing body. They had gotten a sign off on the Alpine and Rock programs, but the ski program was brand new. So I did guide on Rainier for 2 years. And in the U.S., you don't need to be a certified guide. More and more of the guides are becoming certified. Whereas in Europe, you cannot guide without this certification. So anyways, I guided on Rainier for a couple years. And there I worked for RMI, which is a great outfit there. And I learned a ton about mountaineering. And Rainier is a special mountain because it's heavily glaciated. There's 26 different glaciers on Mount Rainier. Wow. You look at all the 14,000 foot peaks in Colorado, and there's not a glacier in Colorado. So, you know, Rainier is a special mountain. It's huge that way. And it was hugely educational to get that time on Rainier. After 2 years of doing that, I got tired of walking down a perfectly good ski hill. So that's when I enrolled in the ski guide program, and it was at its infancy then. I took the exam the following year, and that was the second year of AMGA certification for ski programs. So now the U.S., at that point, that was 99, I took the exam. In 98, if my dates are correct, the U.S. became sanctioned as an IFMGA country.
Okay. What's your favorite hike to ski destination?
When you say hike to ski, you mean pure touring?
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's no lift. You don't have a favorite? They're all, well, rattle some off so our dear listeners can sort of get an idea of where you've been.
Well, I mean, Europe for sure is special because you can tour for weeks on end with a day pack and a credit card, which is pretty nice because they've got amazing huts all over. And when Americans hear hut, they think of a little ramshackle shack that
the Grinch lives
they can sleep five people and stacked on top of each other. But these are rustic hotels. They sleep 100 people. There's great food. And so they're quite different. So Europe is amazing to tour in. And there's unlimited. There's huts everywhere. And I mean, favorite areas over there. I mean, the hot route is classic that goes from Chamonix to Zermatt. You're going to the same hut as virtually everybody else in the hut.
So where's a more exotic? Where's a more exotic destination where you're not so crowded?
At most of these, the huts sleep 100. So say the Bernese Oberland, which is where I took my exam, actually, in Switzerland near the Eiger and the Munch and Jungfrau. So in that region, again, you're staying at a hut with 100 other people, but there's no set traverse. And so you walk out the hut and people scatter and everybody's climbing a different peak. So that's really special. Just touring around home in the States, I mean, the Cascades are amazing because they're heavily glaciated as well. Baker trip that I just did, we left from the ski area. And as soon as we got out of the ski area, you didn't see a single person for 4 days. So that's really cool too. You have to carry all your stuff, of course. So your pack is heavier and it changes the dynamics, but it's equally special. So I like going back and forth. I prefer not carrying a heavy pack these days. Not that I ever did. I mean, a heavy pack is never fun to ski with. Everything's getting so much lighter now too. My pack now, compared to when I first skied Rainier, well, I didn't know what I was doing then either. I had a pack that was so heavy. I had a sleeping bag you probably could have slept on the moon with. I carried so much stuff, I could barely lift my pack in the parking lot. I actually tried to shoulder it and couldn't lift it and thought, oh, I'm stepping on a strap, and then realized I wasn't stepping on a strap. It was just that heavy.
Do you have any mountain that's still, or region that's still on your bucket list?
A couple. I mean, mountain ski area, I've, through my time in the ski industry, I've virtually skied every single resort in the U.S., except for one major one, and that's Big Sky. So that's on my bucket list, but I should tick that off next year because the Hall of Fame induction is there, so I'll be in the hoods. And as far as regions, I mean, yeah, there's a whole bunch, but I'd love to go ski with the penguins in Antarctica.
Okay.
But that's a long trip. That's,
pull your little sled along.
No, I don't want to pull a sled. I did that on Denali, and that's no fun.
Sounds gruesome. Let's switch gears for a moment. You and I have been around this rodeo for a while, and one of the places we used to have a grand old time would be the SIA show. And people who are not part of our little industry don't realize what an important event that was. Even if you wrote no orders, being there was important because it was where everybody came together. It's where everybody met. And, yep. And that congruity, I'm sure it matters in all other sports, but I think skiers have a special gestalt, a special feeling to when they're together. There's a awareness of shared risk, even though the levels of risk shared are wildly different. But there's something about bringing the ski industry together where the energy is more than the sum of its parts. And that was a magnificent time. It's gone now. Can you address to some degree what we had and what we've lost?
Yeah, I think you're right. It is special. And I think skiers do like to congregate and brag about what they may or may not have done that day. That's why Après is so good. This was kind of like the Après for the industry.
Yeah.
When everybody got together. And it really did bond the community together. And I think that's, you know, now that's, it's not completely gone. There's still the OR show, and we'll see what happens with the OR show this year. COVID didn't help, of course. Anytime you have a 2-year lapse and companies realize, oh, I just saved $500,000 by not going to the show and we're still in business, they go, maybe we don't need to go. And it is expensive. So maybe it needs to be scaled down to smaller booths, but I still think it's important to get people together. I walked out of that show every year smarter than I went in. And you can always say, yeah, well, you can call those people, you can go see those people, but half the information that you got there, you didn't know you were going to get. So you wouldn't know who to call or who right. to go see.
I remember one time there was it seemed sort of impromptu, because I remember this exchange taking place somewhat in the aisles, but you were leading a discussion about telemark. It was at some crossroads in telemark technology, or maybe you had to do with the mystique of where you mounted it on the ski, but there was some sort of contretemps that, and you were in the thick of it to try to explain to people, give them all a reality pill. You remember what I'm talking about?
I do. And I don't remember which show that was. And I think it was a discussion on bindings, because in my eyes, bindings are what held the sport back. Of course, when I was involved with Telmark is right when Shape Skis came out, and we built the program at K2 based on Shape Skis and fatter skis and women's skis. And of course, I didn't have a Telmark background. I came into it the very tail end of leather boots, and so I didn't have any of the old baggage that the historians had, you know, the purity of leather versus plastic. I'm like, plastic is better. I can ski better. So I don't care about leather. I had the benefit of a little bit of foresight, because we had been testing all this stuff. You know, we tested Shape Skis. I knew it worked for Alpine. I know that there's not that the mechanics of the turn of what the ski is doing are the same. So this is going to work for Telmark too. So, and I don't remember what that discussion was exactly, but
you were preaching.
I was going to say I was opinionated on it, which won't surprise a lot of people.
Well, you made a lot of good points, as I recall. Let's talk R&D. You and I have played similar functions there. Neither of us are degreed engineers, but it was our job to communicate to those engineers what it was they were supposed to be working on. And then to figure out how to, in Solomon, we also wanted to carefully wrap the product in a thick layer of bullshit, so that it would go protected out into the market. And I was, of course, one of the bullshit masters. I would put on my turbaned hat and conjure up stories. And if you told a really good story, you sold a lot of stuff. So from our point of view in R&D, let's kick a few ideas around. Let's talk about the word handmade and how it's used to try to promote brands where the term really should be poor quality control. In other words, you know, we're trying to say, oh, everything was handmade. Well, does that mean you have any, do you make the same ski twice? Can you make the same ski twice? Is that really what the customer thinks handmade is? I think people are preying on an image which is simply divorced from the reality of how almost all skis are made.
Yeah, there's no question. They're playing on the fact that most consumers have never been in a ski factory, like a real ski factory.
Right.
And if you've ever been at K2 or Blizzard or Fisher or Rossi or any of the big manufacturers, you see that all skis are handmade. There's a ton of handmade touches that go into that ski. It's not like you push a button over here and pour all the parts into a barrel and it spits out a ski at the other end. So there's a lot of craftsmanship that goes into that. But what the big guys have that the little companies don't have is 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years of making mistakes and learning from those mistakes.
Right.
And also having a massive R&D budget that can sink millions into machinery and engineers and finish machinery so that you get a superior product. Because you might be able to flex a ski in your garage shop and get a flex number on that ski, but that'll give you an overall flex. Whereas the big brands can dissect that every centimeter along the ski and tell you, well, maybe these two skis have the same overall flex, but this one is super stiff in the tail and it's got a softer shovel, or this one's really soft underfoot and stiffer at the extremities. So that kind of detail you can't get without big money behind it.
Now, you and I had talked about this not too long ago, and you posed a couple of questions that you would sort of say, dear Mr. Indie Ski Maker, two questions. Can you build a better ski today than you did 10 years ago? And two,
of course.
Do you think you could make a better ski if someone gave you $10 million to upgrade your tooling? I think the answer would be yes. I could.
Of course, right? I mean, everybody's
there are limits on what they can do because they don't have more than 10 years of experience. Most of them are right around 12, right? Oddly enough, a lot of them were born at roughly the same time. And all of them are undercapitalized.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't. I mean, if you're building, you know, 1,000 skis a year or whatever the number is, you can't possibly invest in this the same kind of machinery that you can if you're building 300,000 pairs of skis.
In fact, your costs are in every way higher.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I've always worked for big companies, so I see what they can do and I see the advantages. The idea of paying 50% more or maybe 100% more for a ski that came out of a modified garage versus a highly engineered, computerized, well-finished product. You know what? Buy a narrow ski and a wide ski from a big brand instead of spending $2,000 on a indie brand. So,
and a good old indie thing. Once upon a time, there was a huge gulf between Alpine Touring, also known as AT, abbreviated as AT, and
already
Alpine
tallied
without the touring. Well, AT, remember, Alpine Touring meant a lot of different things to different people over the course of time, depending on what
sure.
country you were in and what was popular at the time. My point is that something that was meant for definitely for touring, for going uphill, that kit, once upon a time, looked very different from Alpine gear. So much so, in fact, that we didn't really have any crossover of people trying to jam a treaded boot sole into an Alpine binding. That didn't happen 10 years ago. No one tried that stunt. They're trying it today with predictably disastrous results. My point is, the streams didn't cross. The Alpine touring world made their super lightweight, climby skis, and you can put all kinds of different bindings on them that helped you get uphill. You're on your own figuring out how you're going to get best downhill. The Alpine ski world operated with a different norm sole, made, generally speaking, different skis, used different materials. The Alpine touring skis, by and large, were made by their own brands. They were brands that the mainstream American Alpine skier didn't. Voilà. What the hell is a voilà? I mean, there were, I don't mean to pick on you there, but I mean, there were lots of brands that were dedicated in Alpine touring and they really didn't bleed into the Alpine side. And ditto, the Alpine side, generally speaking, didn't bleed much into Alpine touring, let's say 25 years ago.
Yep.
But now there is a huge smudging and blurring. Let me set the stage just a little further and then I'm going to turn it all back over to you. Just this year, Nordic introduced a new mini series of skis that they stuck in between Enforcer and Unlimited, which was their Unlimited was touring, and it has its own little catalog to just reinforce that point. Enforcer is basically wider skis, but inbounds resort service.
Free ride. Yep.
Free ride. Woohoo! But then they introduced Unleashed to fit somewhere in between there. And K2 did the same thing where they had Wayback for human-powered off-trail skiing, and they had Mindbender for in-resort, but primarily off-trail skiing. Well, they've inserted Dispatch now in between, three different models that are for lift riding and or climbing, but they have a little more priority on the descent. In other words, they keep on trying to slightly redefine each little new segment. Blizzard added the Hustle series this year.
Yeah.
This is apparently supposed to be a climber, but an even more avid climber, someone like the slow-mo people who, despite the name, race up the side of the hill, it seems, in the early dawn to get to the top of places where I have never gone. They added the Hustle series to a line that already included Zero-G and a five-model touring family, and then they introduced the Zero-G LT. They've got three lines in a brand that 15 years ago had zero. Zero G was because there were zero models. In each one of these instances, a Nordica or K2 or Blizzard, they've tried to wedge a whole new product series into a market that, in my humble opinion, is already monstrously overserved. We have enough ski models made for climbing skiers now than there are climbing skiers. Now, I realize that we've had a huge influx of interest, especially during the pandemic, for saying, come on, America, let's all go in the backcountry, especially by non-endemic writers who don't know how dangerous that idiotic appeal is without a bunch of other provisos, like get your education, make sure you're in the right gear, no, go with someone who knows what they're doing, don't do this, it's your first ski day. My question to you with after this long preamble is, are there more slices to be made in this market? Which way is the market going? Are they going to keep proliferating things for this half-climbing, half-non-climbing hiking market? How many American hikers are there anyway? I mean, if you knew from your own internal research at Black Diamond, what's this? Are there 5 million hikers now? I mean, we used to think there was only about 8 million skiers. It now seems like we got enough models anyway to serve a really large community of off-trail, non-lift-taking skiers. Isn't the backcountry getting awfully crowded?
Certainly, parts of it are getting more crowded. No question. I mean, if you need a Jackson Hole 20 years ago and went up to Teton Pass, you get up there whenever you wanted and park and go for a tour. Now, if you're not there at, I don't know what time it is, 6:30, there are no more slots in the parking lot. So it's definitely getting more crowded. There's more people getting out. I mean, there's a whole bunch of questions packed in here. I mean, in terms of how many people are touring, the market is definitely growing. And it depends on what you want to call touring too, because as you alluded to, there's a lot of ways you can slice this. Probably the best way to gauge the market is how many pairs of skins are sold. Although that's not quite accurate either, because a lot of skiers have two or three sets of skis. So they have two or three sets of skins. Whereas some people have an Alpine free ride boot that's geared towards the resort, but has walk mode and tech fittings and is not very light, but skis well. And they're putting a shift or a Duke PT on or even on the more touring side, a Fritchie Tecton on an Alpine ski. And that's their everyday setup. So talk about pure touring, people driving to the trailhead, that market's small. The ski market's 20,000 pairs, but that's pure touring skis. And there's plenty of people putting a touring binding and driving to a trailhead with an Alpine ski. So 20 to 40,000 pairs there. And whereas Europe is 10x that size. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, are we slicing it too thin? You're right. It was pretty simple in the old days. It was black and white. You had a touring setup that was good for walking uphill and not very good for skiing down. And you had an Alpine setup that was great for skiing down, but impossible to walk in. And that was it. You were in one or the other. And then 15 years ago, I think Salomon was the first to come out with a QST boot. And actually Black Diamond came out with a boot called the Factor that was pretty visionary for the time too, because it was focused on descending. It was not, I don't know if you remember, it's all about the down campaign, but that boot was visionary. It was not light,
right?
But you could ski it at the resort and you could walk in it. You're just walking slower. So you had Alpine brands building touring boots, and then the touring boot company started adding more buckles and more performance until this gap from pure Alpine to pure touring was filled in every single slot on the wall. There's something available. So it's great for the consumer from the standpoint that wherever your mindset is, if you want a true ski setup that you can ski at the resort or go in the backcountry on, there's a slot right in the middle. If you're skiing 90% at the resort, but you want to tour a little bit, you can go there. The trick is figuring out which one is appropriate for you and lining up the boot and the binding to match the ski, because you can drop a Ferrari engine in a Volkswagen. It's not going to perform like a Ferrari.
The part of that engine that I worry about the most is the binding, because people buy, I see this all over our area here around Tahoe, people buy backcountry equipment, get good enough on it, like it, and decide now they want to ski it in resort. Now, for some bindings, Duke PT, Salomon Shift, no issues. But for a classic pin binding, That binding has the energy curve. By the way, dear listeners, an energy curve is a way of describing the amount of shock or induced shock so the system can absorb and return to center and keep the skier skiing. And a typical alpine binding has an energy curve that is big and fat. A typical climbing binding looks like that big fat thing got run over by a truck several times, and it's a little squiggly worm. It has almost no shock absorption. The reason I'm talking about this is we have a really important training problem in this country because people don't go to enough lengths when they're selling. They just want to close the sale. Ooh, I sold it all. Well, you don't have to be a genius to sell a complete setup of backcountry equipment these days, but you do have to be aware enough to tell people this is your backcountry. Repeat after me. This is your backcountry setup. Because if you take it in resort and ski it and ski it and ski it, you will fatigue that binding. And then it will fail just when you need it to not fail. Address, please.
No, I think you're absolutely right. There are a lot of really, really good touring bindings now, and that's one of the areas that's really helped that sport progress. Dynafit obviously started it all, and everybody's adopted that design in different variations to produce different bindings. And some of those bindings do have more elasticity than their predecessors, but still, as you point out, nowhere near what an alpine binding is. And if you're going to ski at the resort any amount of time, you should get the safest system you can. And that's an alpine binding that has a lot of the elasticity and shock absorption and better energy transmission too. So as you point out, Shift, Duke PT, on the touring edge of that is the Fritchie Tecton, which has elasticity. And actually the kingpin has a little too in the heel, but not right. In the toe.
Right.
You know, it's fine to do a day or two at the resort, but I wouldn't put a whole bunch of time in that just because I have a replaced knee now. I don't need another.
Aren't you concerned as a guide, a person who might be called on to be also a rescue person, that this wave of particularly the last 3 years of new backcountry skiers are going to rely on their friends or the internet, which is a swill bucket of lies, in lieu of actual avalanche and BC training? There's just so much bad advice out there saying, come on, it's just like walking. You can do it. It'll be great. Grab whatever you want. Bring your friends. Bring the kiddies. It's all great. And in this rah-rah is all the nuances lost about the dangers of just binding booting compatibility, just to pick one. We have a little window of 1970s injuries recurring from people trying to jam whether they're a grip walk or fully treaded AT boots into alpine bindings with absolutely 1,000% totally predictable results. They break their leg, just like
yeah.
1971.
I mean, I don't know how prevalent that is. I don't think there's that many. Race coaches have been doing that forever. but I think in terms of are people going out unprepared? Yeah, for sure some people are. The internet actually, I think, is a double-edged sword. I think there's a lot of really good information on the
I've
internet, too,
that
you can learn a lot. And obviously, the safest way to learn to tour is to get a setup, and you don't even need a beacon, shovel, or probe, and go skin up your ski resort if they allow it. And that at least gets you to feel what it's like to walk. But in terms of being in the backcountry, most of us learned by going with a friend who knew more than us. And depending on how much the problem with that is, as a neophyte, you don't know how much your friend knows. They might not know much more. They know more than you, but that might not be enough. So as a guide in Europe, there's a massive amount of people hire guides, and partly because the terrain is more fierce and intimidating. If you see big glaciers and seracs and ice falls and crevasses, it's like, fuck, I'm not going out there by myself. I need a guide.
You can look across the canyon and see one of them break loose and you go,
ooh. Right. whereas here you don't have those kinds of dangers. And the only big danger is avalanches, of course. And that just looks inviting. It's like a foot of new snow on a 35-degree slope. Doesn't look intimidating at all. Yeah, I think if it's something you want to do, you'll get a lot more out of it by hiring a guide or taking an avalanche course. I mean, to me, the big problem I see is so many people take an avalanche course and go, okay, now I'm good. When even if your avalanche skills are good, which they're not right after you take a course, that takes years of getting out there. But there are a lot of components to touring that have nothing to do with avalanches, that getting lost and setting safe skin tracks and knowing how to set an efficient skin track and navigation and all that stuff. So I think the best way to get into the backcountry is A, take an avalanche course, or better yet, take an intro to skiing course that will wrap that avalanche knowledge into ski touring and tour planning. And that's really, I think, where you're going to get the best fundamental back.
Where do you find this guru if they can't find you? Where do they? What avenue does the guy who says, "Yeah, I want to do it the right way"? So, Jackson, who do I go see? Who's going to give me this big picture training? Is it access to your local ski school, or is it going to be a special?
No, it's not your ski school, because they have nothing to do with the IFMGA or AMGA and guiding. No, it's you need to find a guide service in your area. And
it'll be called a guide service. There's no other.
Yeah. And if you're unsure, go to the AMGA website and they've got all that information. You can say, "Hey, I want to go ski touring, and this is where I live, or these are the regions I'm willing." Maybe you want to travel for it. If you don't, I think it's good to do it in your home mountain range, because if you live in the Pacific Northwest and you take a course in Colorado, the snowpack is so different. That it's not going to be as educational as if you do it in your home mountain range.
Good point. You just completed a tour of duty at Fisher, successfully, by the way. Smiles all around. I don't know how many times I've seen someone leave a job and have everybody happy. But I thought I detected your fingerprints on Fisher from the moment you showed up there. Suddenly, they produced a ski boot that was the best boot they'd ever made, and it was a hybrid hiking boot. Where the hell did this come from? This place used to produce these clodhoppers that weighed 100 pounds a piece. This thing skis beautifully. Well, that's interesting. And then just this fall, we'll be posting this podcast in the fall. We'll be recording it in the spring, dear listeners, but we will be showing it to the public and the world at large later this year, at which point the new Ranger line will be in shops. Did you get the ski line that you wanted in all respects, or were there one or two refinements that didn't make the final cut? Were there any things that you sort of like to have seen, and maybe one or two models that didn't happen for whatever reason? I'm not trying to churn disappointment. I just want to sort of share with people that you don't always hit the ball over the fence when you're working with product design.
No, you don't. For the most part, that line, I think, turned out really good and hit all the things we were looking for. There was a few skis that I would have liked to see different. I would have liked to see more metal in some of them.
I thought that they underdosed a few, and I attributed it to trying to keep this male female ability to be, you know, bisexual skier. I don't know. Please don't get enraged at me. No angry letters. Fisher has an ideology even that says, "Hey, the best skiers, male or female, the ski doesn't know what gender you are, so we make him exactly the same." And in the past, Fisher had skis with some metal and skis without, and they weren't pitched as the ones with metal were just for guys necessarily, but there was some hint of, you know, sex, you know, differentiation there. But there is no differentiation of any kind, to the point where they actually took the suffix WS, women's series, they scrubbed the suffix. So the alternate cosmetic for the Ranger 96 is just a yellow ski. Doesn't say WS or
no. The intention wasn't to make it binary that way. There's a lot of different input that goes into ski design, and some of it has nothing to do with performance and has more to do with economics and how much this part costs and that.
That's what I'm talking about. I mean, that's very, very real. I mean, of course you want to share parts as much as you can, but sometimes it goes too far. And I've seen it in important brands. I'm not saying that Fisher isn't an important brand, but brands that have command of more of the U.S. market, where they have not really rationalized any sort of male-female differentiation, and where the product, if it's not optimized for one or the other, it tends to be compromised for both.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I don't think, because we had skis that were men's skis that we put a women's graphic on it and it won the women's test. So I don't think it was that. I think the other thing is you have X amount of time. It's like writing a paper for college. You write it and rewrite it, and pretty soon you just got to turn it in. It doesn't matter if it's done or not.
That's why I had trouble in college, because I got a little trouble turning it in.
So there's some of that too. It's, you know what, we did, COVID interrupted testing and you couldn't get as many tests as you want in, and it's not perfect, but it's good. I got to comment on the boot, because you said as soon as I got to Fisher, things improved. And right when I got there is when the Ranger boot came out. And I'd love to say that that was because of me, but
nothing to do with
as you know, that was in the works for a couple of years before I got there. So I wish I could say differently, because I think that was an amazing boot. It was really light. That was lighter than my touring boot 10 years ago. Hmm. And it skied way better.
Yes. It was a big eye-opener.
They've done a great job with boots, and I'm still skiing in all my Fisher boots.
Cool. So to wrap this up, looking forward, as they say, we'll be airing this in the fall. By then, people are going to know that you were working with Black Diamond, you know, in the ski division. So when you add more Alpine product to Black Diamond, are you going to try to push that through your existing channels to market, or are you going to expand your distribution to embrace more of the Alpine specialty dealership?
We have Alpine skis right now. We have an Alpine Freeride collection. And yeah, that's one of the things I'm working on, is building a new collection. So certainly a huge chunk of our distribution is backcountry shops, but just like the skis and boots are not cut and dried backcountry resort anymore, neither are the shops. So a lot of our shops, a lot of our distribution that may have been traditionally touring shops have expanded into that Alpine side. So we already have a lot of dealers that are selling Alpine products. Will we expand into new dealers? Yeah, I'm sure we'll expand somewhat, but it's not going to be a wholesale change that we're going in the full Alpine distribution.
Is the backcountry channel to market as a separate channel, as opposed, in other words, that is specialty backcountry, specialty touring? Is that market in fact growing? Are we seeing more storefronts?
Yeah, for sure we are. And I think the stores that are doing it are also just selling more of it.
Yes.
Because there are certainly some core shops that have remained purely touring focused and don't sell any Alpine bindings or boots or even on the heavier side. So
their profit margins are probably better.
There are a lot of those stores that are thriving.
Cool. Well, thank you, Mike, for spending so much time with me today. I really, really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Jackson.
I'll try to make it up to your induction at Big Sky.
I hope so.
Maybe we can get Stumpy to actually ski at that one. that'll be a challenge.
He was threatening to ski in Sun Valley this year. I thought we'd get him out.
I thought we would too. I sweated bullets with him for hours getting that totally atrophied right foot into a boot, which I did. And he can put it on without help, and he doesn't have to wear his brace and the boot. Everything's going to work just fine in it. But you can't get him to step into a binding.
Stumpy was a good skier too.
We'll get him in. We'll push him over that edge. His whole life is opening up now that he's got money in his hand from having stole Stump Tower and his and Casey's place in Prineville. And you know he's gonna be the worst danger to the modern world, because he's gonna be Stumpy loosed with $100,000 in his pocket. This could be a movie. We could follow him around and make a movie. That'd be awesome. Thank you again, Mike, for a wonderful time. You've been a great friend, and all success with Black Diamond. You certainly deserve it.
Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to it. Appreciate the time, Jackson.
Yeah, appreciate it too. This has been Jackson Hogan with Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.